Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Many people ask, if Planet X is within our solar system at the present time, rounding the sun, then why is it not visible? Well, it is, and it has been during its approach, and I'm here to tell you the saga. All that I'm telling you, backed up by images and photos and reports, is documented on my website, ZetaTalk.com. Take the link from the photos section. Early in the Zeta Talk saga, the Zetas gave coordinates on where the inbound Planet X could be sighted as one gazed out from the Earth toward the constellation of Orion. Planet X was coming from this direction, and during its approach seemed to take a contorted path. From the spot where it was first located by NASA's infrared team in 1983, it at first swung counterclockwise in the normal direction Earth and the other planets in the solar system take. Due to what the Zetas call the sweeping arms of the sun, which reach out from the sun and brush all the planets in the same direction, round and round the sun in their orbits, this planet, inbound, Planet X, at first took this direction. Counterclockwise is the normal direction of orbits as seen if one is perched high above the solar system looking down. Then in 1997, as it came closer, it reversed this direction and assumed a retrograde orbit, the retrograde orbit of legend, going clockwise. As it was coming straight at the sun, it found this to be the easiest way to deal with the sweeping arms because it could, like skipping rope, jump over the arm rather than be brushed ahead of it. This was because it was coming in at increasing speed and coming closer to the sun where the sweeping arms were stronger. Boring straight at the sun, coming in from the direction of Orion, it was at first found about 11 degrees below the ecliptic. For those not familiar with astronomy terms, the ecliptic is the sun's middle. You know how Saturn has rings around it? Well, the sun has rings also, but they're just not visible. All of our planets are lined up around the sun's middle as though the sun had rings, like the brim on a hat. But as it came closer, as Planet X came closer, it seemed to rise to the ecliptic as we looked out in that direction toward Orion. Well, this would be like, if the sun and its ecliptic is like a hat with a brim, then this would be like a man saluting, bringing his hand up to his forehead. That's the direction that Planet X was taking. So from our view, as we looked out, it seemed to be rising from below the ecliptic, or the middle, the brim of the hat, up to the brim of the hat. In 1997, the view from Earth showed Planet X close to this ecliptic, or brim, and starting to move retrograde. And then by 2001, it started to plunge down below, go south again. What was happening? Legend states that this monster planet, Planet X, comes into the solar system at a 32-degree angle, and this was where it seemed to be heading after 2001, going into 2003, dropping, plunging below the ecliptic down to that level. Per the Zetas, the ecliptic is a crowded place with lots of particle flows that man is really only dimly aware of flowing back into the sun's middle, brushing back in, as well as some particle flows flowing out, and Planet X was simply taking a less crowded path. It's kind of like a commuter van getting off the expressway and taking a country road on its way into the city to avoid all the traffic jams. It was here, as it was starting its plunge in 2001, seen just above Orion's bow, and that's where it became visible from observatories. Prior to that, it required specialized infrared equipment or a clear view like the Hubble might have and provide, and this equipment was in the hands of very few, and thus the cover-up could be maintained. Those few with that type of equipment, access to the Hubble or access to infrared equipment at a observatory, were under a national security oath not to create panic in the public. Anything alarming might be found, they were afraid of runs on banks, people making demands on the government, people not attending to their jobs, just running screaming in the streets. In fact, NASA had done a study, a think tank conference, and concluded, and this is public knowledge, that if there was something immense, like what they call an extinction-level event, likely to happen or pending, they would not tell the public. And this was their conclusion. So this is how they're operating. It's like UFOs or motherships that can be seen by the Hubble or in observatories. NASA's airbrushing UFOs out of their images all the time. And there's nothing coming out of observatories or NASA about these UFOs. They don't admit to them because that's another cover-up. Don't tell people that aliens exist. Don't tell people that the crash at Roswell involved aliens. So, Planet X is a bigger issue than that. It's more alarming than the alien presence, and the cover-up is definitely there. In 2001, then, as it was due to be visible from observatories, three separate teams in France, Vancouver, Canada, and Arizona set out to view Planet X from their local observatories. I quote from an excited email received from Véronique in France on February 7, 2001. The Neuchâtel Observatory got it. They're very excited, wondering if it's a comet or a brown dwarf, through the latest coordinates that you gave, I'm going to ask for further details. The daughter of the astronomer reports that they suspect a comet or a brown dwarf on the process of becoming a pulsar since it emits waves. End of the quote. The observatory later denied that it was used for such an observation, and the astronomer who promised Véronique that he would provide her with images was never given permission to release his images. Excited by this discovery, others planned observatory visits. But the word had gone out, the public may be visiting you, so the next two sightings at observatories found their view temporarily blocked by scaffolding. Could this be a coincidence? Hardly. Scaffolding in two observatories, in Flagstaff, Arizona, and Vancouver, Canada, both just conveniently blocking the view to Orion? And I quote, on the night of Sunday, April 1, 2001, I reserved the historic Clark 24-inch telescope at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, for my own private viewing. As it turns out, the telescope operator was unable to point the Clark in the direction of Orion because there was a scaffold in the way which only the operator's supervisor was allowed to move. I didn't suspect conspiracy at this point, but heck, who knows? In any event, the operator was determined to give me my money's worth, and he opened up the McAllister telescope, a newer but smaller scope, with a 16-inch mirror. We trained the big doohickey on the coordinates given for April 1, 2001. The operator told me he didn't see anything there. I asked if I could take a look. There were three stars, I assume they were stars, near the periphery of the viewable area, but absolutely nothing near the middle. I had asked the operator earlier if the scope would be able to see something as far away and faint as, say, Pluto. He said he had seen Pluto with this scope once before, but it was so faint he could only see it out of the corner of his eye. So I focused on the periphery of the viewable area while directing my attention to the middle. Lo and behold, there appeared a faint blip not too far off center. I looked long and hard, but I wasn't sure if I was imagining it or not. I asked a friend who had come along to take a look and told him what to look for. He said maybe he saw something. I asked the operator if he would take a look in the same fashion. He looked carefully for a couple of minutes and confirmed what I saw. I took another look to satisfy myself. Yes, there was definitely something there. I had the operator center the telescope on the faint object so that we could get the coordinates more precisely. And then I checked a third time to make sure we were talking about the same thing. We were. The elusive blip was centered now. The operator described the object as diffuse and of approximate magnitude 11. End quote. Well, the coordinates were within scant seconds, not minutes, from the coordinates given weeks earlier by the Zetas. A second confirmation after the France sighting that these coordinates were valid. In my opinion, this was one of the strongest confirmations of Zeta Talk prediction accuracy, that these coordinates given to several decimal places, down to a fraction of seconds of a degree, proved to be so correct. Note these coordinates are of a moving object, and the sightings consistently confirm the object moving according to these Zeta Talk coordinates. The Flagstaff team sought confirmation that what they and the operator had sighted was not a known object. An astronomer they contacted confirmed, and I quote, "A look at the digitized sky survey images of the region shows nothing diffuse within a quarter degree radius from the position we gave. There are no known comets in the area at the time. The area would have been well surveyed for moving targets by the Linear Project in New Mexico, so it is unlikely a bright comet would have slipped past them." End quote. Following this April 1st, 2001 sighting in Flagstaff, a third attempt was made in Vancouver, Canada, on the evening of April 8th, 2001. Again, the view to Orion was conveniently blocked. And I quote, "I and a friend of mine made it down to the Gordon MacMillan Southam Observatory tonight and had what I believe was a very strange experience. I called the observatory around 7:30 and spoke to some guy and asked if it was okay to look at an object near the constellation Orion. He said that there was some large pipe that had been placed in front of the observatory and was not sure if he could swing the telescope in that direction, but that I might be able to see something. He recommended coming around 8:30. When we made it there, he seemed helpful until he asked what I was looking for, and I said, well, possibly a comet. I told him I had exact coordinates. He said optimal time to look would be about 9:30, and there was also a full moon tonight, but it was not up yet. We hung around outside for about a half an hour, looking through some telescopes that some amateurs were viewing with, and headed back to the observatory to make sure this guy did not forget about us. From that time on, he completely ignored or avoided us and hung out outside, mostly. Nothing too off-kilter yet. Finally, it's 10 o'clock, and I go outside and ask him when we can move the telescope. He then offhandedly replies that Orion has gone below the horizon, and we wouldn't be able to see anything anymore. I said even at the declination 16, which he replied that, well, maybe we'd be able to see that high a declination. When we went back inside to put the coordinates on the computer, his behavior became what I would describe as markedly disturbed. When I read in the coordinates, he entered the first in wrong, and after I corrected him, only entered into three decimal places and then rounded up when he should have rounded down. He remarked that the other decimal places were not necessary. I didn't persist because I felt we would be in the ballpark. He then moved the telescope, went over to the eyepiece, came back, muttered something about trees, moons, horizons, or something, entered new coordinates, moved the telescope and left to the other side of the room and began talking to some other people before I could even say a word. I was quite perplexed and wasn't sure what had happened, but I wasn't going to give up. I approached him again and asked him if he looked at those coordinates. Well, he said he had. Nothing there, and tried to brush me off. I asked him if we could move it back so maybe I could take a look. He then brought out some big star chart book, opened it up, pointed to the very bottom of the map on the page, and said it was very low. I then persisted if that was the right area, and he then changed and pointed to near the top of the map. I said we should be able to see it then, no problem, and again directly asked if he could move it to those coordinates so I could take a quick look. It was like he was speechless, looking around blankly, brought out another book, opened it, started babbling on about nothing until I stopped him and told him that we'd been waiting 2 hours and could we please take a look. He then re-enters the coordinates, which I read off again, and moves the telescope. I go to take a look. Near the center, I see nothing that I think looks like Planet X, but at the very top right corner, if I moved my head, I could see what appeared to be a darkish, diffuse, round spot, fairly large. I asked him if that darkish spot was anything or just an optical flaw, and he said, oh, well, it was an optical flaw. We were viewing Saturn earlier, and I didn't recall seeing any dark spot there, and I thought it was strange to have such a large flaw on the eyepiece of a $200,000 piece of equipment. He then handed my friend a handheld controller that had about 6 dials or buttons on it, and said he could move the telescope around and walked away. No instructions. My friend looked at me like, what the heck am I supposed to do with this? I looked through it several times, and the spot was definitely discernible. I then approached the guy, thanked him for his time, and gave him a friendly pat on the arm. He did not respond or look up at me. When we left, I asked my friend if it was just me, or was the guy acting really strange. My friend felt that he was acting strange, and at the very least, definitely not trying to help us. My feeling was that this guy's mind was under the influence of fear. I'll try again next weekend, weather permitting. End of the quote from Vancouver. All that odd behavior on the part of the astronomer in charge that night soon had an explanation. On a return to Gordon MacMillan's South End in Vancouver on April 20, 2001, and I quote, I was able to speak quietly with a different operator and got him to open up a bit. He admitted to me in hushed tones that he was aware of the actual existence of the object I was looking for, Planet X, end quote. Thereafter, this Vancouver observatory was visited by NASA within a few weeks, who gave a big lecture and then closed down ostensibly for a couple of months for repairs. Well, in fact, it was closed down for over a year. Such is the fear that the public will learn that an inbound planet, known to cause pole shifts on Earth in the past, was on the move and inbound. Here's the report from May 8, 2001, from Vancouver. At the observatory tonight, I also saw the original operator that I had dealt with on April 8. When I approached him to say hi, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. I swear he almost went into the women's washroom to avoid contact with me. I hope he's not being leaned on too hard. I attended a meeting tonight hosted by the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada at the H.R. MacMillan Space Center, where Ray Villard, Director of Public Relations of the Space Telescope Science Institute, was giving an update presentation on the Hubble. At the end of the presentation, one of the staff from the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada informed the audience that the Gordon MacMillan Observatory would be closed for at least until the summer. Since there were so many astronomers there, I decided to ask some people if an object could be accurately located, if someone gave only the raw in deck to a competent operator at a modern observatory. The answer was yes in all cases. In fact, it appears that this is an extremely accurate method of locating an object according to the nice and helpful people I spoke to. So that makes 4 knowledgeable astronomers that I have asked this question to, and they all came back with a positive answer. End of the quote. For those not aware of astronomy terms, Ra and Dek are essentially an X and Y coordinate mark in the sky. So what did the Zetas have to say about all of this? And I quote, This is an example of what the persistent public can expect when looking for Planet X in an observatory where someone has been told to stall. You must admit, he did his best. How many blocks did he throw in your way? How many times did he point you in the wrong direction? How many times did he try to discourage you by failing to help? Now, why would an individual do this unless under orders? In the context of an individual looking for his paycheck to continue, and his boss to consider him a team player, and his chance of promotion or recommendations for other jobs he may have ambitions to get, this behavior is not all that unusual. End of the quote from Zeta Talk regarding the Vancouver incident. When Orion again became visible in the nighttime sky, which occurs really from fall to spring, optimally during the winter, in 2001 to 2002, it had come closer. The constellation of Orion is light-polluted during the summer as the Earth moves round in her orbit to where one must look past the sun's glare to look in that direction, what astronomers refer to as a constellation or star being in the sun. So, in the winter of 2001 to 2002, it was now being captured in infrared scopes at observatories. This was a significant difference because Planet X has its own fire, being a smoldering brown dwarf. This showed that it was not only inbound in that it was showing up on infrared, but also that it was moving according to the zeta coordinates as the earlier sightings at observatories had shown, but it was also a heat-generating planet. Again, three teams captured this infrared from Florida, France, and South Africa. The first capture on December 5, 2001, was by someone working at a university associated with NASA, and from the email sent to me from someone who had been corresponding with this individual, it was pretty clear that he considered it his job to look for it and then debunk it. He said, in essence, I'm going to look for it, and then when we find it, I'm going to tell you what it is. It sounded suspiciously like debunking to me, and that's what he proceeded to do. The image was taken and provided to PsiAstro Usenet individuals. This is an astronomy Usenet. And it was posted out there with a challenge, okay, Nancy, where is it? And that was the subject line of the posting. Well, I took that image and I drew a red circle around a spot where the Zetas were telling me to draw a red circle. And when that image was then contrasted by other people adjusted in Photoshop and the like, what do you know? A fuzzy object appeared where no object was supposed to be. No object on the star charts, no known object. Well, that individual who works for NASA at a Florida university is saying it was anything but a passing comet, an asteroid. He has lots of explanations. But nevertheless, once again, at the Zeta coordinates, there it was. And this was dated December 5th, 2001. The second infrared capture was from someone from France, a student of astrophysics there who was allowed to use the observatory equipment for whatever he wanted. Little did the observatory suspect where he would point that telescope. And I quote, he had access to the Haute-Provence Observatory in France, and he had the opportunity to point to the coordinates you indicated. End of the quote. Well, when compared against the star charts again, ESO, European Southern Observatory Digital Sky Survey, or a Palomar Sky Survey, where all existing known stars and nebulas and the like are recorded and shown on an image, so you can compare your image against these known images and see if something is new. Boy, there it was again, a dim, fuzzy, glowing object at the Zeta coordinates, which had moved from where it was on December 5th, 2001. this capture at the France Observatory, I guess I'm pronouncing this right, Haute-Provence Observatory, was on January 19, 2002, good 6 weeks later. The third infrared capture occurred in South Africa, but was not made public, nor was it made known to me until later in the year. And there's a reason for that. This individual made arrangements to travel from Zaire to South Africa. Professional individual, accompanied by another professional individual. She was a chemist, and had made an appointment with the South African Observatory to use their scope. The reason I never got that infrared, or it was never posted, was she began to get harassed. She had allowed me, when she told me of her plans, to use her full name and email address to be posted on the SciAstro Usenet. She had allowed me to use her full name and email address because the Usenet was always accusing me of making up these reports, and non-existent individuals were going to observatories and I was making up these stories because nobody's full name was being used, etc. Well, if anyone wonders, and it's often said, you know, if this was going on, amateur astronomers would be buzzing about this information. Well, the Usenets were buzzing about this information, but harassment was being done. People reported to me that they would get tons of email, or their computers would be hacked into and like destroyed, or there would be threats made against them. But this was clearly documented. This woman, who was a professional chemist, went with a co-worker to South Africa, where she had made an appointment. And because the posting was put on the SciAstro Usenet ahead of her visiting there, somebody contacted that observatory and said, "Don't let that woman near the scope." Here's her report. "Dear Nancy, although we're not financially independent, you are more than welcome to use our names. As I mentioned, the trip was 1,400 kilometers, 2,800 both ways round trip. The astronomer at the Sutherland Observatory, after several telephonic confirmations, refused permission to view. The observatory is the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere, a 74-inch scope. We do want to make a big issue out of this so that people can realize the truth." End of the quote. She told me later that she'd gone to a second observatory after this refusal on December 19, 2001, and had later located the fuzzy, dim glow at the zeta coordinates, as had the others. What harassment was she getting? Her phone was tapped, and she was getting threats. All this for a non-existent planet. All this for a chemist in Zaire wanting to look through a telescope for a non-existent planet. Now, moving into the fall viewing season and the winter of 2002-2003, the Zetas warned that Planet X would now be visible by amateur equipment. And I quote from the Zeta Talk, fall of 2002. "Given the changes from February 2001 to January 2002, where the anxious public went from needing to go on to an observatory to view to getting their hands on infrared imaging equipment to image, what can the public expect going into the winter of 2003? We have stated that the planet increases speed exponentially on approach. Thus, a rapid increase in size and visibility, as in brightness, will occur during the fall of 2002 and the winter months following." End of the quote from Zeta Talk Fall 2002, written in June 2002, looking forward to the fall. So by the fall of 2002, a determined team of amateur astronomers planned to use an online rentoscope at about $100 a pop, their own expense, to capture the images at the zeta coordinates regularly. Well, they also had to get up in the middle of the night. The images, known as FITS files, F-I-T-S files, are huge and full of detail, and considered virtually impossible to doctor because of that. The team made these FITS files available to the world and reported regularly on their findings on the web. distance, the Planet X complex looks like a fuzzy star. It's composed of the planet itself, what I call the corpus, and dozens of moons in individual moon swirls trailing around behind it, all this surrounded by immense dust cloud of red dust, iron oxide dust, magnetized so it clings close to Planet X. So, nevertheless, from a distance, this complex looked like a singular object, that fuzzy, dim blob that people were reporting. Coming closer, the dust cloud spreads out, the moon swirls fan to the side, and the closely shrouded corpus, the Planet X body itself, begins increasingly to look like a fuzzball in a fog bank. By December 4th of 2002, the moon swirls had become visible as separate from the planet itself. And I quote, "There are some spots that I have circled that I cannot find on any comparison images. They also show up fairly well on all the frames. What on earth are these spots? Could they be space trash riding in front of Planet X? Moons trailing behind in the dust cloud?" End of the quote from the imaging team that was working from that fall 2002 into the spring of 2003 using a rental scope which can be operated online from a distance. In other words, you pay your money down, you get on your PC, and you can move the telescope remotely, take images, and have those images, all for $100 a pop or an hour or so. And the Zetas explained, and I quote, "Going into the analysis of the November 15th images, we advised the team to start looking for the tail and the swirl of moons and debris within. Although coming under much ridicule on SciAstro for stating that the moons of Planet X followed in a swirl, a perpetual dance among themselves for dominance in being the closest moon to Planet X, this is precisely what the imaging is now presenting. As Nancy would say, Zeta's right again. The moons are not at all as large or bright in the images as Planet X itself. They are reflecting light solely, not generating it as Planet X is, and thus will always be the lesser. How many moons and how large are these in comparison to Planet X? They rival the size of Earth's moon and are numerous in the dozens when the smaller moons are included. That so many could have been captured by Planet X is due in part to its rapid passage through the solar system as a stationary setup with circular or elliptical orbits rather than a trailing swirl would have pushed them out from each other afar enough to cause some of them to be lost from the gravity snag of Planet X." End of the quote from the Zetas. By December 13, 2002, the moon swirls were captured as moving during the night's imaging session. The Zetas again explained, and I quote, "Over the course of 2 hours, one of Planet X's moon swirls moved discernibly. The moon swirls are, one, in a dance among the other moons in the swirl, two, in a dance with other moon swirls, and three, in a circular motion behind Planet X itself." End of the quote. By December 28th, the giant tail and individual moon swirls in the tail had not only become visible as separate from the planet itself, they are also seen as a large blob on the images when they overlapped each other and thus were denser.
Hello, my name is Steve, and I'm going to be talking about some of the extensive CCD imaging that was done in the fall-winter of 2002-2003 at the Zetatalk coordinates for Planet X. Nancy had provided very precise coordinates months ahead of time through Zetatalk, so it was just a matter of someone taking the time to do some imaging and showing what was there or was not there. I found a private observatory in Arizona where telescope time could be bought and images taken remotely through the internet. It was a very high quality and easy to use setup using a 12-inch Moulin telescope and FLI Dream Machine CCD. I took the first set of 10 images on September 15th, 2002, Initially, when comparing the images to existing NEAT and DSS images for that area of the sky, there was nothing too exciting to see. However, closer examination did show some new spots that were showing up on the images. The raw FITS files were released to the general public on ZetaTalk, and the images were downloaded by the thousands. Over the next few months, many new images were taken, and by now we had a sighting team that would help take the images and analyze them as they came out. At this time, there are also numerous debunking sites that sprang up and would immediately analyze the images and profess alternate explanations as to what was showing up, hot pixels, noise, poor processing, lack of team experience, etc., etc. And to an extent, they had a point, as nothing overly dramatic was showing up on the images at this time before December. We were seeing faint objects nearly at the threshold of visibility, showing up on a percentage of the images, but not all across the board. Something elusive was there, but was growing more visible when analyzed after each imaging session. The beginning of December is where we really started to see some dramatic images. Several new objects were showing up and being seen across all the images. By the end of December, there were large splotches, which the Zetas described as being moon swirls. It was also in December that I decided to report these objects to the IAU Minor Planet Center to see what they would say, and after filling out and sending in all the information as they wanted, corresponding back and forth several times, they ultimately flat out would not look or comment on the images. If there was nothing there, then why at the least would they not say so? But they would not give any comment, positive or negative, even though the objects that were showing up were now rivaling or were even brighter than most of the stars on the images. It was expected that this association would not touch these images, and this just proved that point. As the months passed, up until March, many, many new images were taken and likewise analyzed. The coordinates were moving fairly rapidly, so each set of images showed a new section of sky. Nancy described the PX complex using a longhorn steer stampede analogy, and I quote, "When at a distance, the entire Planet X complex of dust and tail and moons was taken to be Planet X, appearing as a dot. The brightness of this complex increased steadily during the fall of 2002 as the complex came closer, a tail haze becoming evident. The tail and moons separated from the Planet X corpus, thus seeming to diminish the corpus relative to the rest of the complex. The tail was then seen as distinct swirls, and when the swirls overlapped as dense blotches, as the complex came closer and spread, the individual moons became evident and separated from each other, thus seeming to diminish the tail density. As the dozens of moons became visible objects, they appeared to rival the heavily shrouded Planet X corpus itself." End of quote. And this corresponds well to what we witnessed with the CCD imaging. It was always changing, and we didn't know what to expect from week to week. At the end of March, the coordinates were now too low to image, but this is when we began to have visual sightings. I believe I had one myself in the beginning of April, a red dot briefly flashing near the coordinates area. Nothing definitive, but was comparable to what other people were seeing. As May came and went with no pole shift, the imaging team disbanded, and PX reportedly beginning to move into no man's land between the Earth and the Sun, with Earth changes continuing unabated to this day. I hope the imaging provided some proof of Planet X and will someday be of some benefit. Thank you for your time, and good night.
On February 26, 2003, it was seen by some pilots high over the Amazon. No longer using a rendoscope, no longer an amateur telescope looking out into the skies, but binoculars, and I quote, "While flying back to Houston from Rio de Janeiro, I believe I was able to see the Nibiru complex with 10 power binoculars. It appeared as a very diffuse area that looked very dimly backlit. We were out over the Amazon basin. The atmosphere was very clear above us. The other two pilots I was flying with were also able to see it with the binoculars. End of the quote from February 26, 2003. This was the earliest report of someone seeing the complex outside of telescope equipment. One of the reasons presumed was that the air over the Amazon is not polluted. It was very clear, and they were very high. So therefore, that improved their view. But by March of 2003, Planet X had moved to be just in front of Orion's bow and was coming visible in the evening sky as flashes of fuzzy, dull red. I personally remember the night on March 26, 2003, when I saw it several times. I drove to rural country roads to get a better view, not polluted by light, and located it each time. The first time, I was coming home from a business meeting and had stopped in a cornfield to look out in that direction, as I knew it was going to come to the time when we would be able to see it, and caught it, and thereafter drove around from one place to the next to confirm. By March 22, 2003, it was projected to be near the orbit of Uranus. That's getting close, coming into the solar system, and thus would be as visible as Uranus. This is because Uranus, like Planet X, is 4 times the diameter of Earth, so same size. So, likely visible. If you can see Uranus, you could see this complex. Reports from around the world began to come in, and I quote, "It has a fiery color viewed through binoculars and cannot be brought into focus sharply compared to other stars. I used a 20 by 80 heliostellar binoculars to view it." And from another quote, "Bless you, my soul. Faithful am I and rewarded I am. Spotted exactly where predicted. The Orion Belt orientation and southwest sky, vantage point from the Sacramento Mountains in New Mexico, was quite precise. Naked eye verification, binoculars only. Closer in, but no more pronounced. Red flickering to the right, then to the north, then nothing. Then flickering again, some yellow noticed on the opposite and sit side of the red on the next visibility. Zeta's right again. I am both scared temporarily and very excited." And another quote, "Saw it last night. Is now clearly red and fuzzy, right in Taurus, like you said, at about 7 p.m., facing west, below Aldebaran." And from another quote, "Both Friday night and again Saturday night, I saw the Planet X complex with my binoculars, 10 power. Could not sleep the rest of Friday night. I was at my farm in East Texas. This is real." And another quote, "Fantastic, unbelievable, heavenly. We see the same red object below the Aldebaran star in Cordoba, Argentina. Man, this is huge and is already scaring my whole family here. Now I realize why we are at war." And from another quote, "We are waiting for pictures and confirmation from reliable sources not linked with the Brazilian government, mainly composed of professional astronomers here in South America who are studying the appearance of this strange red object in our skies. The object has appeared naked eye last Friday and is visible in some regions of South America, as confirmed by many people in Uruguay, Peru, Argentina, and Brazil. The coordinates given by the Zeta Talk match with our viewing in South American skies." End of the quotes. The Brazilian astronomers confirmed the sighting a week later, and I quote from Brazil, "The answers were that this object has the same composition and mass of an unidentified celestial object discovered in 2001. End of the quote from Brazil. The Zetas explained that these sightings were of the entire complex, and thus the morphing and fuzzy appearance that people began increasingly to describe. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Fire Dragon, "What the unaided eye is seeing is the complex as a whole, not the corpus or moon swirls. The corpus, the moons, and dust cloud all are reflecting sunlight in addition to reflecting light from the corpus itself, and this combined light is what is reaching the eye. Soon, those gazing at the evening sky will find that they discern a tail haze, moving as during the December 2002 time frame away from the corpus in its motion in the sky. The next phenomenon that will be observed will be distinct moon swirls in the tail haze, such that separate streams appear to be trailing the corpus." End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Fire Dragon, written March 29, 2003. While Orion was dropping below the horizon at this time, it's only a visible complex in the night sky from the fall to the spring, best viewing in the middle of the winter. In the summer, as I have mentioned, one must look past the sun's glare, the constellation being, as astronomers say, in the sun. So in March, it was beginning to drop below the horizon. You would be able to see it just very early in the evening, 8 o'clock or so, 7:30, and now the sun was up longer, so it was lost in the glare. So it's beginning to become a daytime object, a daytime viewable object. But reports were still coming in as we moved from late March to early April 2003, and I quote, "Wow, I am blown away. I live in South Oregon and it's been cloudy here, but I got a brief window tonight and got out a small pair of 12 by 16 binocs at work, and there it was, blinking in and out, red, in the spot where I could not make it out just last weekend. Can't wait to see it with my 6-inch reflector. Now I know what to do and am afraid to bring others' attention to it and frighten them. Wow, what times we are in. Hope I can handle this." And another quote, "I can see it here in Oklahoma City without a telescope. I have a 10-inch telescope with a 25-millimeter colossal eyepiece that's about 50 power, and you can see reddish-brown tail dust." And from another quote, "Three of us tonight saw on a clear New Zealand night an object that was not there 1, 2, even 4 weeks ago. The coordinates matched the Zeta site predictions. Just one person needed binoculars. Just make sure you're looking in the right area. You can't miss it." And yet another quote, "I've seen this below Taurus, as your sighting page says. This was not Aldebaran seen earlier this evening. I am still worrying and not sleeping. Sky's very clear here in Ethiopia, so no mistake. I am a yachtsman also. The planet is very big. We have rumors, too, that unrest among tribesmen citing this occurs here in Ethiopia." End of the reports from early April 2003. Photos began being taken. One from North Carolina, very dramatic, as it showed like a double helix around, coming out on either side of Planet X as the dust and moon swirls trailed off behind the corpus. All that complex coming straight at us that time looked like a flying globe that ancient Sumerian pictographs had, a globe with wings on either side. Thereafter, as the Earth moved around in her orbit such that Orion could no longer be seen in the night sky, but only through the glare of the sun, these sightings of a red dust cloud and a winking red planet stopped to be replaced by reports of a second sun rising and setting. Planet X had arrived by midsummer 2003 to be so close to the sun that the glare of sunlight off the dust cloud, reflecting back toward Earth, back toward the view from Earth, was a blaze rivaling the blaze of light from the sun. People reported seeing two suns rising and setting. This was captured dramatically from the webcam on top of Mount Wilson in California, on film, and on the Zeta Talk website in the photos section. After this came the buzz on the internet. Mount Wilson refused to point their webcam in that direction. Now, why would they change the direction of the webcam if there was nothing to hide? I quote from Zeta Talk, Second Sun. "The distinctive appearance of Planet X in the sky, as reported by the ancients, as a fire dragon, can readily be understood by those viewing Planet X closely, as the swirling moons and dust cloud already give this impression. The appearance has also been described as a second sun. Orange is as predominant as red in the color spectrum coming from Planet X. Orange is the color of the rising and setting sun, preceding the sunrise and lingering in the evening after the sun has set. For Planet X is coming toward the sun from beneath the sun as well as from the side. Dawn and dusk will be the best times for visibility, and noon is worse, as light pollution is strongest at noon. As with all other viewing, this depends immensely on the viewer's location, determination, and clear skies. This was a quote from Zeta Talk, Second Sun, written April 19, 2003. This Second Sun even appeared on TV when the rising or setting sun was pictured behind a weatherman, for instance, on a live cam, startling those on the set into comments about this double sun right there on TV. And I quote, "On the Phoenix News this morning, May 25, 2003, there was a story and pictures of what was described as a planet by the sun, right around 8 o'clock a.m. After about 15 minutes of speculation on the part of the newscasters, a meteorologist came on and explained it all as a weather balloon at about 100,000 feet. Well, it didn't look like a weather balloon. And from another quote, "My roommate works for CBS News. Everybody in the biz knows something is up. The local stations reportedly are taking dozens of calls a day." And this was about June 3, 2003. And another quote, "Last night, July 4, 2003, I observed the most incredible setting of two suns. I watched a brilliant white light setting for almost an hour. I thought the sun was gone, but I looked back to see a bright red sun appear in the exact same location. I watched two suns set." And another quote, "In Montreal, I was going to watch sunsets with a friend on July 6. According to stats, the sun was supposed to set at 8:44 p.m. Well, at 8:40, we watched the sun setting, and the sky was awesome. Red, orange, very bright light. Then the light faded somehow, but around 9 o'clock, it became again very orange, very, very bright reddish color, and it was like the sun was setting again." End of quote. Two shadows were also evident by midsummer 2003, one cast by the sun and one cast by the second sun. And I quote, "We were sitting on our porch this morning, June 29th, which faces east, just ahead of noon, and noticed that the railing was showing two different shadows on the porch floor. When the sun went behind a cloud, the second shadow from some sun-like object would appear, bright enough to cast a shadow almost as dense as the sun's shadow. This second sun-like object had to be both smaller, higher, and to the right of the sun, as the shadow it cast was within the sun's shadow, as though the sun itself had suddenly moved higher in the sky." End of the quote. The additional light reflecting off this massive dust cloud, bouncing back to earth during the day, was making the sunlight seem harsh. People began to notice their garden plants were being scalded, their own skin getting sunburned too quickly. The red iron oxide dust was also evident, not only in the red skies and occasional blood-red moon, but also in deposits on cars, in bird baths, and on patio furniture. This all just began in 2003.
Hello, this is Steve, manager of the group's forum site, Skywatch, at MSN.com. In May of 2003, I began taking a series of photographs which revealed a comet-like image situated to the far left of our sun at or near the 9 and 10 o'clock position. The images were taken using a CCD zoom lens camera, which included a high-resolution lens filter for reducing much of the solar glare attributed to CCD images, which in turn substantially reduced the lens flare. Therefore, I felt confident that the photos I posted at Skywatch and those that I sent to Zeta Talk for review were credible and would be more difficult to discredit as being a solar anomaly or a phenomena contributed to refraction of light. The images of a second sun appearance continued throughout 03 and into 04 as the Great Red Comet continued its rise to the ecliptic, which is the orbital plane in which the Earth, our moon, and all of the planets of our solar system revolve around the sun. Imaging of Planet X was possible during this period because it was still located in back of the sun, where its vision was not obscured by blinding solar light. Furthermore, because the tail of this planet, also known as the Great Serpentine, was fixated in the general direction of the Earth, I was able to obtain some extraordinary images of cosmic red dust entering our atmosphere, being blown in by the solar winds. This summer, we are once again witnessing the presence of this red dust in the sky. unlike any dust that has ever been witnessed by man. Nancy has these photos on her website, and they signify the real probability of a large planetary body entering our solar system. It is another of the many signs given to us prior to the great pole shift. Beginning in late 04, imaging of this rogue planet became less observable as it moved more directly between the Earth and the Sun. This is a result of the Sun's intense light interfering with our ability to properly photograph sightings. During the period when imaging was more feasible to the naked eye, we had noticed that the comet-like object was moving counterclockwise in a retrograde orbit around the Sun from left to right. Coincidentally, most photos taken between the spring of 03 and the summer of 04 seemed to ascertain a general orbital theory that Planet X was indeed moving in a sling orbit across our solar system. Continual eyewitness accounts from the general public and photos capturing a second sun image in the sky in 03 and 04 appeared to be too much of a coincidence for naysayers to dismiss as nothing more than a composite of solar anomalies or simple hearsay by those who proclaimed that they saw something quite unusual in the sky. The skeptics of the world will never be convinced, irregardless of the evidence that may be presented. Proof, on the other hand, is in the eyes of the beholder. It is said that those with an open mind who are conditioned to accept the great scheme of things will be given the ability to understand that the Earth in its present state cannot endure the test of time. What we are witnessing is not just a natural phenomena or a cycle of cataclysmic events that have always occurred throughout the history of the world, but rather a transformation of spiritual and physical well-being. The Hopi Indians best described this concept when they spoke before the United Nations in 92. In their address, they remarked, and I quote, "The Earth will witness increasing floods, more damaging hurricanes, hailstorms, climate change, and earthquakes, as our prophecies forewarned. Why do animals act like they know about the Earth's problems, and most humans act like they know nothing? If we humans do not wake up to the warnings, the great purification will come to destroy this world, in the same manner as the previous worlds were destroyed," end quote. Nostradamus, in his legendary quatrains, also described in surreal time what to expect in the latter days due to man's ignorance and unwillingness to change. In his quatrain number 34, Century 3, he remarked, and I quote, "When the eclipse of the sun will then be, in broad daylight, the monster will be seen. Everyone will differ on the interpretation, high price unguarded. None will have prepared," unquote. How ironic that the revelations of our past and present prophets and seers have given considerable credence to what we are now witnessing today on Earth and in the heavens. It's also apparent that alien civilizations are forewarning the world with the inclusion of crop circle formations that depict the passage of a planetary body between us and the sun. Zeta Talk and Skywatch were founded on the principle that we are to be messengers in service to mankind, that our ultimate survival depends on our ability to contribute to the physical and spiritual welfare of all nations in the latter days. I personally had the privilege of meeting with Nancy in September of 03 in her hometown in Wisconsin, and I was invited into her humble and modest surroundings. I can personally attest to the genuine sincerity of Nancy Later's message to the world. Her integrity and unselfish willingness to spread the word about the planet of the crossing is truly inspiring. I feel we can all rest assured that Nancy continues to have our best interest in mind, and I thank her, bloginservice.com, and other webmasters who give of their time and resources to the betterment of mankind.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.